We're turning now to topic number 16, the Shia or Shiite Muslims. When Muhammad's wife Khadija died, he was very discouraged, depressed about that. And then shortly he did marry another wife and other wives. He had a number of wives. As long as Khadija lived, he only had her. He had no other wives. And one of the wives he was especially, one of his favorites. He treated them all equally, of course, as prophet, he was supposed to do that. But Aisha was very special. And she actually came into his home when she was a little girl. Not that the marriage was consummated at that time, but this Aisha, this young girl, comes into this home. And he has a daughter called Fatima. And no Muslim has ever shared this with me, so I may be completely off the mark here. But as I see it, these two girls, Aisha and Fatima, they're in the home of Muhammad, had a struggle. They struggled with each other. And after Muhammad died, this struggle became present within the whole community. And it was a struggle over leadership. And Fatima and her husband Ali believed, there was a whole group following them in this conviction, that the descendant of the Prophet Muhammad should be the leader of the community. And of course, since Fatima was the oldest child, he had no sons. Muhammad had no sons who lived. Since she was the oldest child, Ali, her husband, should become the leader of the community. And then you had the wider, larger group in the community who disagreed with that and believed that it should be the community who decides who the leader will be. And Aisha was part of that group. In fact, a very vigorous defender of that understanding. And of course, Fatima and her husband were with the other group. And so this deep divide developed in regards to leadership within the early Muslim community. And so the Sunni group believed that the leader should be chosen by the community as a whole. And so and Ali and Fatima believed that he should be the leader. So the first three leaders, Abu Bakr and Omar and Uthman, those first three, one after the other, were within the Sunni movement. They were not related to the Prophet. They were not his descendants, and they were the leaders. They were called the caliphs, you know. After Uthman was assassinated, then there was a struggle, and Ali now became the leader, Fatima's husband. And so now the Shiites have won the struggle, but the struggle continued. And in fact, it finally led to civil war between the partisans of Ali, who were referred to as Shiites, and the wider Sunni community. And as I said, Aisha was with the wider Sunni movement, and Fatima and her husband Ali are giving leadership to the Shiite movement. This struggle eventually led to Ali was killed in the war, in the civil wars going on and so forth, and then his son Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet, became the imam. The Shiites called the leaders of their movement the imams, and the Sunnis caliphs. So Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet, became the leader after Ali was killed in these wars, and then he was martyred. Hussein was martyred in Karbala, in present day Iraq, and you know these annual pilgrimages that they take to Karbala, taking place now since the Saddam Hussein regime is no more. It's all about that, going there to Karbala where he was assassinated, where he was martyred. And so this whole struggle brought this great divide within the Muslim movement. with one wing, about 90% of the Muslims being Sunni. The head of the community is the Caliph. And then the other wing being the Shia movement, and the head of the community is called the Imam. And the Imams within the Shia movement are always descendants of the Prophet. And he takes on to himself the Quranic authority. They see him as an incarnation of Quranic authority. It's a little bit like the Pope in Catholic theology, who has the keys of the kingdom. And this Imam has Quranic authority. And he is infallible. He makes no mistakes. The infallible leader, you see. And there's a group, there's a variety of Shia movements because of disputes and so forth about which of the sons of the previous Imam should actually become the new Imam. So you have groups like the Ismailis and so forth and so forth. The largest group are called the Ithnashari, or the Twelvers, and they would be the Iranian Shia movement. Iran is almost 100% Shia, not 100%, but largely Shia, and they're called the Twelvers, the Ithnashari. The reason the Iranians are referred to as the Twelvers or the Ithnashari is because after the 12th Imam, the Imam, I mentioned this the other day, the Imam vanished. And so they say that he vanished because people were not obeying him. And this happened 800 years ago. And so for 800 years, the Iranian Shia have not had an Imam. But they say his spirit, his occultation, prevails. And like I said yesterday, the work of the Ayatollahs is to tune into this occultation and to put together a political religious system which is in harmony with his thinking. And they believe, they're very eschatological, they believe that as they follow the occultation, the inner wisdom of the Imam, 12th Imam, his spirit, that then he'll come back again with Jesus. And that's what the whole Iranian revolution is about, just straining forward with great expectation for the coming of the Mahdi, who vanished 800 years ago, and they think they just about have it together, you see. The political religious system, which is in harmony with his thinking, and so he is delighted with what they're doing, and he will most certainly return with Jesus to bring about the establishment and the spread of Islam throughout the world, probably, and certainly peace and justice throughout the world. That will be their mission. And so a lot of discussion about what all that means, but that is the ethos and the spiritual tug of Iranian Shiite Islam. But then you have the Sunni wing, which is the larger wing, and as I said, they're led by the Caliph, and the Caliph is chosen by the ulama, by the wise men of the movement, and so for them, there's no imam with infallible authority who leads their movement. The Caliph is not infallible; he's leader of the movement, and he combines spiritual and political power. The Caliph, that's his responsibility. However, among the Sunni, when Ataturk became the general in Turkey, instituted his secular revolution in Turkey, he dismissed the Caliph. And so from the time of the Turkish secular revolution to the present day, there is no Caliph at the head of the Sunni Muslim movement. They have none, you know. So for the last, 90 years, there's been no 80 years, there's been no leader within the Sunni movement. The Caliph resided in Istanbul. As we move into the 20th century, that was the seat of the Ottoman power, the Ottoman Empire, and that's where the Caliph resided, because the Ottomans had suzerainty over the Sunnis worldwide, and he was dismissed. So for that time to today, there is no authority that speaks for the worldwide Sunni movement. Which, of course, is one of the crises within global Islam. Who speaks for the Muslims? Where is that authority to be found?
Even a small contribution can make a big difference. Jesus fed over 5,000 people because of a little boy's 5 loaves. Regardless of the amount, your contribution is very important and greatly appreciated. Visit us at www.tvseminary.com.
So it's important to have some awareness of this division and the difference within these two movements. Let me pause for questions, and then we'll bring this to closure. Yes?
Which group are the more Muslim people?
Are the more?
Among the whole Muslim people, I mean the Islam. Which group is bigger by percentage?
Okay, well, the Sunni would comprise, I think, about 90%. So recently I was reading a figure written, an essay written by a Shia who said that the Sunnis comprise 80%. I guess it's not sure. But between 80 and 90% would be Sunni, and between 10 and 20% would be Shia. And remember, Iran is the largest Shia community, and Iran is essentially Shia. You do have significant Christian minorities in Iran, Armenian Christians particularly, and some Zoroastrians, but the country is basically Shia. And the whole Iranian revolution is a Shia revolution.
So when they make a mission, when they try to convert someone to the Muslim, how they divide among the new territories, or how they, like right now in Russia, many former Soviet Union republics, and I heard this name mixed up, the Khalifat or Imams or something, do they still fight even in new territories, or how they divided the mission field or something?
Yeah, well, oftentimes the Shia and the Sunni work together quite peacefully, but also oftentimes there's tension. Witness what is going on in Iraq today. And it's the legacy of Saddam Hussein, to be sure, but the tensions are very, very real. And so I don't think one can make any universal claim. Some places in the United States, for example, the Shia and the Sunni worship together in the same mosque. And some places in the world that would be unthinkable. The problem, of course, is that from a Sunni perspective, the way in which the Shia have elevated the Imam to be infallible and the incarnation of Quranic authority feels to them to be heretical. It feels almost as if they're giving an associate to God. Whereas for the Shia perspective, in our modern world and throughout history, it is necessary to have a leader who has the authority to interpret Islam contextually within the world in which we live. So the Shia have a much more kind of incarnational kind of view of authority than do the Sunni. And so theologically, there's significant divergences. When I was in Iran at that Mahdi conference, I heard 21 sermons, I guess it was, on this whole Mahdism. And I was impressed with how very high the Shia elevate the leader of the community and the Mahdi. I tried to imagine Sunni Muslims sitting there and hearing that, how they would feel. And I could get a sense of the tensions, the theological tensions, as I sat and as I was bathed in this Mahdi theology for 2 days, hearing sermon after sermon about it. But then, you know, there's a kind of space and dialogical space with the Shia, which is Sunnis likewise oftentimes, but I think especially the Shia, which is quite remarkable. I was amazed that they invited 5 Christians to come to that meeting, and 3 of us invited to make presentations, myself included. I was trying to imagine a conference of Mennonites somewhere in the world on the incarnation of Christ, and inviting a Muslim to give a sermon on the Islamic take on the incarnation. I don't think we would have done it, but here they invited me to speak on Jesus, and I shared with him what I shared with you yesterday, his journey to the cross, which is not an Islamic take at all on what Jesus is about, but it's a desire to hear the spiritual streams throughout the world, which led them to do that. And I just admire them immensely. I think it's just wonderful. Yes?
The caliph that were dismissed in Turkey, and is there any attempt now to restore the caliph among Sunni Muslims?
Yeah, I think that the world Muslim movement feels it would be hopeless to come to the kind of consensus necessary to restore the caliph. You know, that's a good question. I don't know what happened to him when he was dismissed. I think he just went into exile, you know. He wasn't killed or anything like that, but he was dismissed. So there's been no caliph. Now, of course, they have the Muslim World Congress, which I guess would be the closest thing to a central authority, but there's no particular person who is noted as being the Muslim, the leader of the Muslim world, like you had when you had the caliphs back there. Al-Azhar University is probably the intellectual center of the Muslim world. But again, many Muslims will critique Al-Azhar and some of their innovative theologies and so forth. And so, there would be a mixed bag. Al-Azhar intellectually probably, as much as anything, represents the center of the Muslim world. And Al-Azhar, by the way, does invite Christians sometimes to address them. A friend of mine was invited recently to speak at Al-Azhar University. Packed out, absolutely packed out. The place just packed out on the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And he is his consummate understanding of Arabic and the Hadith. And he exegeted the Hadith to make a case that Christ was crucified. And afterwards, the rector said, "You know, this is something we need to hear." He had an ovation after he was finished, the rector said, "We need to hear more about this." So, within Al-Azhar itself, there's often more space than you might think for theological discourse and dialogue taking place. Yes.
Maybe I missed that. While there is no caliph for Sunnis, who is the imam for Shiites? Is it Iranian president, or who is the imam right now?
Well, since the 12th imam, they have had no imam in the Ithna Shari movement, the 12ers movement. For 800 years, no imam. But they're waiting for him to come back. They say he vanished because people were not obeying him. When the society finally is obeying him, then he will return. So like I said yesterday, instead of the imam, you have the ayatollahs. And you have this council of ayatollahs who discern who should be their leader. And he is called the great leader. The great leader. And the great leader recently said, in this conflict about the elections and everything, he said, "I speak with the authority of God." That's good Shia theology, you know, to critique us. And my authority is to critique God's authority. We represent the authority of God. What he said, as I understand it, as I read it in the press, I hope that I'm not misquoting him, but it would be authentic is Shia theology, a comment like that. For in Shia theology, the imam is the incarnation of Quranic authority, and he is infallible. So be careful about critiquing him. It's not a very wise thing to do to critique an authority like that.
Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. 2 Corinthians chapter 9 verses 10, 11. How to give to TVS Ministry. You may give online at efta.org/givenow. In the description place, write Russia Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Or make checks out to EFCA. Write on the check memo line, Russian Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Mail to EFCA Donor Services, 901 East 78th Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55420-1300. Or send your gift through PayPal for tvs.gift@gmail.com.